Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never. And I have to emphasize that debt is fraud. Just so you understand, we go through this every time I kind of explain this. Just because the Constitution gives them the good faith and credit of the United States doesn't mean they can take debt out for just anything that they want to take it out for. It's just like passing a bill that requires, you know, the spending of money. As a matter of fact, it states right there that there has to be a mechanism of covering the expense. Now, that's for those things enumerated. Just because they come along and say, oh, well, we're going to kind of create a tax for this. No, they can't tax us for things that they had no authority to do. Just like spending money. They can't spend the money. They can't do those things. So regardless of what side of this cube you want to enter into the box with, it's all unconstitutional. So so let me just move forward, because I've been trying to, you know, kind of close out this exorcism, and we pretty much did. But there's one thing that you need to understand, that the Constitution guarantees us a Republican form of government. And in that Republican form, it guarantees that our representation will be 30,000 to 1. In other words, we're going to have adequate representation to where we won't be drowned out by this big sea where those few people that have more money get a louder voice. The framers kind of understood in many ways those things that influenced our government. And they wanted to make a system that would allow us to influence it. There's nothing worse. When we start talking about getting our representation back and you hear a government person say, well, that's just going to increase your spending. I don't think if we actually had representation and held our public servants accountable, we wouldn't be in these trillion-dollar deficits at all. And as a matter of fact, when we really think about it, by design and where we are today, we don't need, and it's no benefit for us to have our representation sitting in the District of Columbia. Now, there's no doubt that there may need to be some, you know, meeting spaces for secrecy and so forth, but the majority of the government that's in Washington, D.C. today doesn't need to be there. First off, most of it's unconstitutional. And then secondly, those public servants, why can't they work from home? Or I should say, at least from the state, whether that's at the county office. And I've said this before, how hard is it to create a federal room or a federal building right next to your county office where your county commissioners meet? If you have a large enough county where your county actually represents, you know, one or two representatives living in it, then why not make it, not a residence, but an office space where they have the ability to actually connect. Now, if they need to connect for, you know, highly sensitive national security stuff, then they should be going down to the state legislature. I've already talked about the importance of getting the state legislature directly involved when we talk about Snowden and intel oversight. That needs to be done by the state legislature. They need to have a SCIF, and so that's where the facility should be. All the regular routine stuff, that can be done out at your county level. Now, when you really start peeling this onion or you, whatever you want to call it, when we start getting into this, the only reason the framers didn't create that type of government was because they couldn't fathom the technology we have today. It's that simple. So, anyway, I will ponder, or I'll take a moment to ponder on and ruminate on my assertion or my position regarding Jews. And as a matter of fact, it's my position regarding anything and everything. I don't believe that at any point in time, you know, far be it for me to, you know, use the homosexual word, any of the demographics out there, the blacks, Jews, anti-Semitism. There's no way in our civil society where we actually should have the ability or being able to drag people out of the street and stone people. There's a process, and the laws actually govern and protect everybody. Everybody. So I know that there's a lot, we always want to have a scapegoat. And if you've never read Thomas Sowell's Black Rednecks and White Liberals, you may want to actually take a little time and read that, because what we're doing today in getting divided and getting all entrenched and and even entertaining, because folks, it's not even entertaining when the Bible forecasts that the Jews, or I should say Israel, the attempt of the earth will try to wipe them out. In other words, how is it that we finally get to a point where genocide is okay in this world? I mean, are we really throwing out a whole race? So anyway, things to think about, things to ponder. Now, as we get back into some content here, one of the things I need to do before I dive into the augmentation of the ratification base, I'm actually going to start reading, and I'm hoping I can find somebody to join me for Mondays, Fridays, and what have you, so that we can kind of read through some of these paragraphs or some of these segments of the ratification debates. That way we kind of, you know, will provide you some extra insights on, you know, very specific positions, whether it's being admitted states into the union, taxation, slavery, or what have you. Anyway, as we were talking about on Friday, I was really talking, and I kind of mentioned, you know, starting the show off, we have a Republican form of government. We have this right of representation. And the First Amendment, unbeknownst to most people, the First Amendment actually galvanized a process into the Constitution, because the Constitution didn't have an allocation for change. We're guaranteed, every 30,000 people are guaranteed, 30,000 are guaranteed their own representative in the House of Representatives. Can't be more than that. It can be less. So in other words, if you have a state that has 50,000 people, then that state would be then represented by two. That's how it works. And so, because you can't water down the representation. The whole point was, and this is why I went through this very specific issue in Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention. George Washington very specifically complained, he articulated that he didn't believe that the people could be properly represented with 40,000. So that's why it was capped at 30. No more than 30,000 people can one representative represent. So in the Bill of Rights, in the very first wave of amendments, Madison included in the very first amendment out of 12, this amendment that dealt with apportionment. And so as we go through this, we're going to kind of dive into that. And as a matter of fact, I believe last week on Friday, I kind of went through this amendment as far as the Bill of Rights goes. And I covered, at least I believe I covered, this, you know, concept regarding what the original First Amendment was to do, and how, because I believe we broke it down that when we got to 100 representatives, the number of allocation of representation would be one representative to 40,000. And then when the House grew, it would then go to 50,000 and it would cap there. There was no allocation for anything beyond 50,000. Now, the Reapportionment Act, as they started playing around and trying to control this, because it's one of the posturings that go back to even before the Constitution, that what we call gerrymandering or Patrick Henrymandering, because there were a lot of different politicians that did this. They played with how to stretch or how to carve through all of the different types of people to make sure that there was enough of a majority of what you want, what you were supporting, like whether it be Democrats, Republicans, or Federalists and Anti-Federalists. It didn't really matter. They just wanted to make sure that they divided them in a way that would create an advantage for a political party, for a political paradigm. And so as we get into this First Amendment, just remember the Bill of Rights. And oh, by the way, if you're looking for the Bill of Rights debates, that's actually out there on my Constitutional Articles page, reclaimingtherepublic.org, Constitutional Articles page. So there was an article written, and actually you can find this article on teachingamericanhistory.org. But there was an article made that basically the title of the article was, "What about the two amendments and three states that got away?" And I'm not going to read you the whole article. I just have a few paragraphs that I think is imperative that I help you get this information or help deliver this information to you so that you can actually make some decisions for yourself. Because here's the question. Should that amendment be applied? And is there evidence? Yes, there's hardcore evidence. So let me just read this. For the original First Amendment, what we shall call the Representation Amendment or Apportionment Amendment, they call it the Representation Amendment, to be part of the Bill of Rights would have required two of the following three states to agree based on who already ratified. So we needed two more of these other three states, Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Georgia. There is no existing guidance about what happened in Georgia. So everything depends on what we can find out about Massachusetts and Connecticut. For the Second Amendment, we shall call the Constitutional Pay Amendment to be a part of the Bill of Rights would have required one of the following three states to agree, Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Georgia, and there's no existing evidence about, again, what happened in Georgia. So again, it all depends on Massachusetts and Connecticut. So now they kind of dive into this. Now, Bernard Schwartz, in Volume 5 of his Roots on the Bill of Rights of 1971, indicates that the both branches of the Massachusetts legislature, remember they had two, in February 1790, after a couple of weeks of debate, approved 9 of the 12 amendments proposed by Congress. They did not ratify the original first, second, and then the 12th. Now, the 12th amendment is what we call the 10th amendment today. So that's interesting that they didn't ratify the 12th. But we obviously got enough to get the 12th ratified. This is confirmed in a report appeared in the Province Gazette and Country Journal dated on the 13th of February, 1790. But even though both branches supported 9 amendments, these decisions was not officially reported to the Secretary of the Commonwealth, and Jefferson wrote to Christopher Gore on August 8, 1791, to inquire about the 18-month delayed status of the Bill of Rights in Massachusetts. Gore responded to Jefferson on the 18th of August, 1791, quote, "It does not appear that the conference committee ever reported any bill, and their decision would not have changed the outcome of the original congressional proposals." Now, to be honest, that wasn't a quotation, that last part. That's a part of the storyline. And their decisions would not have changed the outcome of the congressional proposals. According to Eugene Martin Laverne, both branches of the Connecticut legislature in 1790 actually ratified all 12 amendments. But the ratification document was misfiled in 1780. It was filed in a 1780 folder or box, however they put it, rather than a 1790 folder. and never reach Jefferson and the Congress. See Eugene M. Laverne versus Rebecca Blank, Acting Secretary of Commerce, et al., number 12, TAC 778. The main point of this discovery, however, is not primarily to correct the historical record, but to correct the constitutional record. As I understand the claim, the document find means that all 12 amendments need to be included in the Constitution and not just 3 through 12. And as a matter of fact, I think this article was written probably before the Second Amendment was actually ratified in the 1790s. I'd have to look. I'm pretty sure that it was a little more recent than that, but maybe not. Anyway, he goes on and says that the concern seems to be particularly focused on the original First Amendment. There is no doubt that Connecticut's role in the constitutional record has been insufficiently recognized, but the restoration of that vital role is not enhanced by the discovery of a misfiled document. It would have required not only Connecticut to vote in favor of the First Amendment, but also either Massachusetts or Georgia. We know that Massachusetts voted against the First Amendment, and we have no idea how Georgia voted. But even if we learn someday that Georgia voted in favor of the First Amendment, there is no need to revise the constitutional record. The original First Amendment was intended to be effective until a certain number of representatives have been achieved. After that, it was up to Congress to set the limit. Now, this is what he is saying. He says, after that, it was up to Congress. No. Now, I'm stopping right here because I hope you understand why that amendment was supposed, or that why that amendment was proposed, I should say. The amendment, the original First Amendment, to change the apportionment made it so, and it actually helped set the tone, that you can't just arbitrarily change a number. Now, just to be clear here, folks, that number is what specifies your right of representation, not Congress's right, not the House of Representatives' rights of who they're going to represent or how many. It is up to us to tell them. So it is for us to have the final say through the ratification of an amendment to the Constitution. There is no part of the Constitution. So this is, you know, I'm reading the whole article, but I have to ponder. I have to take a pause and actually excoriate this author for not understanding this. Why did we have the 11th Amendment? Because it changed the context of Article 3. Why do we have the 12th Amendment? Because we made minor changes to the process of the Electoral College, or in the choosing our electors and their choosing of the president, that process. Very minor changes. The point is this, is that if there's going to be any change to any language of the Constitution, it needs the buy-in by the states. Apparently, this gentleman or this person that was writing this article really felt that it was kind of left to the federal government. Oh, well, Congress can, you know, they can make statutes. They can change things any way they want to. And they don't have that authority. That's the whole point. That's the whole driving point of why the Article 5 process is there, is to make sure that there is a mode to change anything. It's not that hard. It just has to make sense. And so, had Congress in 1929 said, you know what, we're going to have to build a whole new Capitol because we need to house this many people, and actually started doing an overspill. In other words, you know, having some over, you know, rooms that they either knocked out the walls and kind of expanded the hall of the House of Representatives and the body of the whole, or they would have had to, you know, get started immediately on an amendment to the Constitution so they get that done. But if they would have came along and said, you know what, we're going to have to build a whole new Capitol because we just don't have the physical space and we can't change that number. Okay, then the people would say, well, why don't you give us an amendment and we'll help you out with that. But instead, they just assumed and did it and assumed the power themselves. That is not how the Constitution was justified. That is not how the states understood the Constitution at its time of ratification. And so the person who wrote this article does not understand those hard set terms and definitions of the Constitution. Anyway, moving, because the whole point of this article is to point out that actually Connecticut did ratify that. They did ratify that amendment. And Congress followed the proportionally, or well, moving on, he says, and Congress followed the proportionally approach until roughly 100 years ago. Then they set the limit at 435. And so that was based on the, okay, so he's actually talking about these other amendments and so forth. So he basically is making the argument that in 1929, with the Reapportionment Act, they set the limit at 435. So that down the road, the amount of people that would be represented by one representative would shift and get bigger and bigger and bigger. So as far as the second original amendment, that is now the 27th Amendment, ratified by the three-fourths of the states on May 7th, 1992. Now the point is the Connecticut actually ratified that. So the other question is, did Georgia ratify that? We already know that Massachusetts didn't. So the question is, what did Georgia do? And this is where the audit would come in. But the point is, folks, that we can actually get more states. And I'm the advocate here. I believe that all we need is getting, if we've already got what, I believe with Connecticut, it's 11, or not 11. I think that there's a total of 11 states that have ratified that amendment since then. All we need is out of that 38, so we need 27. Is 27 too hard? No, I don't think so. As a matter of fact, when we start initiating, based on what we're doing with these petitions, and as we go through this a little bit later, we're going to show how these petitions at the state, at the county level, can drive the state into state conventions and reframing their constitution and taking back their roles and responsibilities at one at the county and away from the federal government. And then two, initiating republic review with other states so that once we get to 24, 25, 26, 27 states, and actually I believe by the numbers as we see it today, it'll take 27 red states to initiate republic review. Well, that's the same number that we could easily get this, what we'll call the very first amendment, which would actually become the, 29th amendment. And I say 29th amendment because they say the 27th is the full, but we've already proven that the 13th amendment from 1812 was ratified. The whole point is the only way we are going to determine what is legitimate, what isn't legitimate. Is that 17th Amendment legitimate? Is the 16th Amendment legitimate? In other words, the assertions by some that say, hey, the 16th Amendment was not properly ratified. If that's the truth, then we can act, and we prove this through an audit, then it's done. It's basically unratified, and the Constitution shrinks, and they change the numbers. It's that simple. The only way to get to the truth is through an audit process. You got to go through, cross the T's, dot the I's. Was the process followed constitutionally? Did they have the authority, those people that did it? Did they have the authority? Because there have been cases, we already talked about Oregon as one of those cases, that actually refused to seat their newly elected so that they could actually and properly engage in the voting of the ratification. And what they did was they kept the old people that were actually being replaced in office. They came back and they were the ones that ratified it. It was some real shenanigans out of Oregon. But anyway, when we come back, we'll start diving into the augmentations of the ratification debates. We'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so we're going to start with Massachusetts. And so I'm going to be going through just a few very specific citations that are either speaking. And the first one up is by General Heath, and it's January 30th. And this one really addresses slavery. And in this particular case, it's not slavery itself as an institution, but we're talking about the importation of slaves. And this is what General Heath says. The migration or importation, etc., is confined to the states now existing only. New states, in other words, admitting new states into the Union, cannot claim it. Congress, by their ordinance for erecting new states, sometime since declared that the new states shall be Republican and that there shall be no slavery in them. Now, what he's talking about is the Northwest Ordinance. Technically, the Constitution did not delineate whether a state could or could not be slave or free. As a matter of fact, it was left to every state to make their own self-determination of how they wanted to do their economics, how they wanted to do very specific things. It was not the federal government's position to tell or force a state to do one thing or another, which is why the Missouri Compromise became an egregious violation of the Constitution. Anyway, so he goes on and says this, but whether those in slavery in the southern states will be emancipated after the year 1808, I do not pretend to determine. I rather doubt it. In other words, there were some people that basically said it would lead to the ending of slavery. Well, technically, it was it was basically forcing the end of slavery. How? Now that they couldn't import more slaves. And as we went into, because we're still being harassed, but we already started noticing that the growth of representation and as new states were joining the Union, because as Louisiana joined the Union in 1804, or 1803. Anyway, when Louisiana joined the Union, they did not join the Union as a slave state. And so the slave states, the money in the slave states, actually started spending and using divisive tactics to try to, you know, continually grow slavery, which is why it boiled to a head with Missouri in 1820. But the point is we were heading into the closeout of the Revolutionary War by the War of 1812. You can't call it anything other than the ending of the Revolutionary War, because this is when Britain came back and said, we're going to take you on with you know, arms and weapons. This is when Britain finally conceded that they could not overpower America. There's no way they could beat us that way. So this is when they actually started, because we were an open nation, and they started using spying and all of that type of stuff. You know, a lot of people talk about how America had, you know, this spy network that was operating. Actually, we were a joke in comparison to Britain. Nevertheless, as we start looking at this slavery issue and the War of 1812, when that finally resided, more states started joining. And those new states, like Indiana in 1816, they were free states. So in other words, we were finally moving in a direction that states weren't joining the Union with the desire of being slave states. If you keep on adding more and more senators that are, you know, anti-slavery, it became very realistic, which is why John Quincy Adams stayed and served in the Senate to actually continue pressing for this, the abolishment of slavery. And that was in the 1820s. But nevertheless, when we look at these new states coming in, when Missouri was going to come into the Union, it was the sentiments were clear. Missouri was going to come into the Union as a free state. And so they kind of slowed, or I should say the advocates for slavery, these franchises that were basically, you know, spreading themselves across the southern states and these new states coming in, this franchise for slavery was trying to stall Missouri from coming in while they were getting judges and politicians and lawyers all honed up and all prepared to actually push for the Missouri Compromise. In other words, creating a divisive line called the Mason-Dixon line and establishing a permanence that states that joined the Union would be slave states in the South and the states in the North. Could you imagine if that would have stuck? Could you imagine if we didn't fight and actually the northern states didn't violate the Constitution by using economic aggression towards the South? Folks, had the North not done it, where would America be and where would slavery be in the world? Because as so America goes, so goes the world. When we ended up getting rid of slavery, it basically got everybody else to get rid of slavery. And we assisted, and to be honest, Britain was another instrument in assisting, but I think that Britain was assisting in ending slavery because it was their way of getting into a position where they could start manipulating many of these foreign states as they were in there helping them or persuading them one way or another, crook or crook, to get them to change their formal position and getting rid of slavery. So anyway, the next augment or augmentation is Mr. Widgery, and this is on Confederalism, and this is Wednesday, January 16th. Mr. Widgery insisted that we had a right to be jealous of our rulers. We ought never to have a power which they could abuse. The fourth section ought to have gone further as far as he's concerned. It ought to have had the provision in it mentioned by Mr. Bishop that there would be a mutual check, and he still wished to be further explained. The worthy gentleman contested the similitude made by the honorable gentleman, the example given by the honorable gentleman from Newburyport between the power to be given to Congress by the fourth section to compel states to send representatives and the power given to the legislatures by our own Constitution to oblige towns to send representatives to the general court or to the general government by observing that the case was materially different in the latter. If any town refuses to send representatives, a power of fining such towns only is given. It is in vain, said Mr. Widgery, to say that rulers are not subject to passions of prejudice. In the general court of which I was a member, I would willingly have deprived the three western counties, he's talking about Massachusetts, from sending delegates to this house, as I then would see it necessary. But, sir, what would have been the consequence? A large part of the state would have been deprived of their dearest privileges. I mentioned this, sir, to show the force of passion and prejudice. So what he's really talking about, and I know this kind of skips out, you know, to touching on a few different things, but really what he's talking about, because he was actually speaking of the advocation of representation, not representation at the state level or what we would call, focused strictly in the bicameral legislative bodies from the state and from the House of Representatives. When we look at federalism and confederalism, federalism is where suffrage is really held at the federal government. They have the sovereignty. They do not provide suffrage for the states. They're just there to kind of be, you know, the reserves from allowing things to get too far out of hand. Federalism, under the guise or by the basic definition of a federation, is where the powers, most powers, are granted or delegated to the federal government, and the states have very few residual powers. In other words, the majority of power is delegated to the federal government. That is converse compared to what we have in our Constitution. Contrary to federalism, we actually have confederalism. And this is what this gentleman's really talking about when he was talking about denying suffrage or representation for these western counties of Massachusetts. He was saying, even though he could have done it, it would have just been, you know, unacceptable. When we understand where the powers are really delegated out, the powers being delegated out to the states and to the people, the way the Constitution is designed, that means that we have a confederation where the federal government only performs very specific services that have been enumerated, only specific roles, responsibilities, and has been granted only those powers delegated. That is the concept, and what this basically, this one little paragraph talks about is the idea that the Constitution or this concept of federalism, it really is what fits the mode of the Constitution. So why is it that when we hear people talk about federalism, it's embraced with this, you know, this enamored, you know, bright twinkling in people's eyes, oh, federalism. Why is it that people act like that? Federalism is an apostate state. Confederalism is the proper forming of this republic. We are a confederation more than we are a federation, by far. Especially when we look at the magnitude of what government is doing today. That's why it is so important that we keep on pointing out. They don't have any power to do education, energy, labor, and the rest of these things. They only have the authority to fight wars. They only have the authority to, you know, guard and protect us and to control the commerce, the flow of commerce. They can control whether we're going to send commerce to foreign states. If those foreign states are hostile, then we will not trade with them. We want to trade and we want to be as neutral as possible. That was the whole paradigm. That was the key to us succeeding at a very young age. Washington didn't have a navy. So Washington basically had to take a very passive position because the last thing we want to do is go out and actually pick a fight with the world empire so that we could be, you know, decimated, and that would just be a waste of life and resources. Even though it's been proven that Britain was not going to be able to ever overcome us militarily. We were too powerful. Or I should say, it was too difficult. We were way too big at that point in time. They could not project enough forces to come to America. You have to realize, you know, we had a lot of people here. and they would have had to send a lot of ships and project, and that takes time. Their ships aren't these big, huge, you know, personnel carriers like we have today. Anyway, so we need to really start understanding, and we need to be aware of the difference between the word federalism and confederalism. Most people, you know, they don't even know that word exists, confederalism. So we need to start helping them understand and learning, because based on the design, we have a limited and defined government that can only do a few things. The majority of the things we have government do may be coming from the federal government. They shouldn't be doing it. And those things were left to the states for the state to do. Confederalism, not federalism. Now, the next one is on Tuesday, January 15th, and this is the Honorable Mr. Rufus King. And this is where he talks about uniformity. Quote, it has been said that our ancestors never relinquished the idea of annual elections. This is an error. In 1643, the colonies of Plymouth, Massachusetts, Connecticut, and New Haven united in a confederation or a confederacy, which continued about 40 years. Each colony sent two commissioners as their representatives, and by this article, they were to be annually elected. About the year 1650, the General Court of Massachusetts instructed their commissioners to propose that elections, instead of being annual, should be only once in 3 years. The alteration did not take place, but the antidote proves that our ancestors have had a uniform predilection of annual elections. In other words, they started actually going to where they were all electing at the same point in time, so that they would have a changeover. It, and as we look at elections today, how difficult is it when we actually have these long-spanned elections? Let me ask you this. When we look at the disparity between one state and the other state, and we're going, hey, is this really, you know, can you really call the election? Because we got to wait for all the mail-in ballots for some of these stupid states that have these wide-open elections. The longer you have an election, I don't mean to go down this rat hole on elections, but I had a long conversation over this weekend. The longer we allow people to be able to do shenanigans, the greater increase shenanigans will occur. If we have the election occurring between 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. local time, that's it. You don't have 3 weeks before, you don't have the day of and a week after, because this is what the progressives want. They want these long spans of time so that they can actually start filling out ballots. The longer time they have, the more time they have to actually get teams together to actually fill in the ballots so they can throw them into a pile and then claim to harvest them. I mean, they've created so many laws that have given them the ability to do shenanigans that only speaks of the power of extending and going out to these extraordinary lengths of giving somebody the right to vote. Now, the question is, do you have a constitutional right to have 3 weeks to vote? Why is it that voting was done in the counties? Why is it the counties were designed that the seat of government of the county was within 1 day's travel? In other words, I'm not kidding. When they actually were looking at the logistics of putting counties and how they made counties, because in the old days, you know, out in the West, it was pretty easy to kind of travel, you know, at least in a straight line. But in the East, with the woods and the forest and so forth, and in the far Northwest, getting around throughout those trees and so forth, that took a lot of effort. And so, especially travel. And so, I mean, it's not like in the desert. Oh, from here to there, I just go straight. I don't have to, you know, avoid obstacles, and in a forest you've got thousands of obstacles because you've got to avoid the trees and how they clump and everything else. So my point is, as we looked at how they were designing these forms of government, or I should say the boundaries for counties, one of the things that they played, and it was very integral in the layout of the county, of where they put the seat, where they put the court and the center of government, because they knew that's where people had to travel to vote. And as a matter of fact, back in those days, elections were considered like a holiday. People would take, you know, if it was a day travel there, then they would be there the night before or a couple days before. They'd stay in town, stay with friends, what have you. They would go participate in the election, and then they would travel back home. That simple. One day, 12 hours. Actually, back in those days, I don't even think they gave them 12 hours. I think in those days you had from 10 to 1 to show up at the county hall or the sheriff's office and cast your vote. And sometimes it was done orally. Sometimes it was done by showing. I mean, it was left to the sheriff to basically determine based on the guidance from the state legislatures. As far as the federal seats, the local seats and so forth, it was actually left up to the sheriff. And as a matter of fact, when you would show up, there's actually documentation of this, that when a person would show up and they're new to the state, if they have not introduced themselves to the sheriff of the county and the sheriff does not know that they are a resident of the county, the sheriff will not let that person vote. You're denied your right to vote. So one of the things that you had to do back in those days, just to make sure you had your opportunity, your full privileges and immunities, is when you moved into town, you'd go and say, "Hi, sheriff, we're moving into this place. And you know, the old Anderson's mill or what have you, this ranch, and we'll be the new occupants, and we'll be living there, and we're planning on raising up our family." I mean, they'd go into lots of details, because back in those days, they didn't have much to hide. Anyway, so the next augmentation is Mr. Dawes, and this is on uniform taxation and commerce, and this is January 21st on Monday, and this is what he says. "But it is not only our coasting trade, our whole commerce is going to ruin. Congress has not had power to make even a trade." Now, he's talking about the Continental Congress, and he's talking about the fact that they are going to be ruined. The power to even a trade law, which shall confine the importation of foreign goods of the ships of the producing or consuming country. If we had such a law, we could go to England for goods of our other nations, nor would British vessels be the carriers of American produce from our sister states. In the state southward of the Delaware, it is agreed that 3/4 of the produce are exported and 3/4 of the returns are made in British bottoms. It is said that for exporting timber, 1/2 of this property goes to the carrier, and of the produce in general. It has been computed that when it is shipped for London from a southern state to the value of $1 million, the British merchant draws from the sum $300,000 under the names of freight and charges. This is money which belongs to the New England states, because we can furnish the ships as well as and much better than the British. Our sister states are willing that we should receive these benefits and that they should be secured to us by national laws. But until this is done, their private merchants will no doubt, for the sake of long credit or for other such temporary advantages, prefer the ships of foreigners. Yet we have suffered these ignominious burdens rather than trust our own representatives with power to help us. And we can call ourselves free and independent states. We are independent of each other, but we are slaves to Europe. We have no uniformity in duties, imposts, excises, and prohibitions. Congress has no authority, still talking about the current Continental Congress. Congress has no authority to withhold advantages from foreigners in order to obtain advantages from them. By the ninth of the old articles, Congress may enter into treaties and alliances under certain provisos, but Congress cannot pledge that a single state shall not render the whole treaty of commerce of nullity. Our manufacturers are another great object, which has received no encouragement by national duties on foreign manufacturers, and they can never be any authority in the Confederation. It has been said that no country can produce manufacturers until it be overstocked with the inhabitants. It is true that the United States has have employment except in the winter for their citizens in agriculture, the most respectable employment under heaven, but it now be remembered that since the old Confederation, there is a great immigration of foreign artisans hither, some of whom are left here by the armies of the last war, and others who have more lately sought than new from hopes of mending their condition. These will not change their employments. Besides this, the very face of our country leads to manufacturers. Our numerous falls of water and for mills and for places for mills where paper, snuff, gunpowder, ironworks, and numerous other articles can be prepared, these will save us immense sums of money that we would otherwise go to Europe. The question is, have we been encouraged? Has Congress been able, by national laws, to prevent the importation of such foreign commodities as are made from the raw materials as the other selves, or as ourselves raise? It is alleged that the citizens of the United States have contracted debts within the last 3 years with the subjects of Great Britain for the amount of nearly $6 million, and that those, consequently, our lands are mortgaged for that sum. So Corsica was once mortgaged to the Genesee merchants for articles which their inhabitants did not want, nor which could not have made themselves, and she was afterwards sold to foreign power. If we wish to encourage our own manufacturers, to preserve our own commerce, to raise the value of our land, we must give Congress the powers in question. And the powers in question that he's pointing to are actually in Article 1, Section 8, where they have the power to regulate commerce, where the federal government will actually have the power to regulate foreign commerce, commerce coming in and commerce going out. Now, they can only tax commerce coming in. They cannot place taxes on American goods going out. That is constrained by the Constitution. In other words, your production of goods cannot be taxed so that Congress can actually play the game of making yours too expensive for the foreign markets to buy. In other words, he's basically pointing out that having this uniformity of both commerce and taxation, imposts, and so forth, and to be controlled, and the necessity of that, that is one of the essence that is basically embedded right there in the preamble of Article 1, Section 8. Folks, we're out of time. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org
and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.